New Medicine Tapes presents The Path of Karma Yoga with Ram Dass, recorded at the Spirit Rock Benefit.
This, again, for those who weren't present yesterday, kind of an uncle to Spirit Rock Center and a tremendous support and inspiration for many of us in practice and understanding the Buddhist community, is Ram Dass. And after yesterday's talk, he kind of left us in suspense. He did the first noble truth and all the sufferings of the world. So let's find out where we go from here.
At this point in our journey, I really can't assume that there's anything really that I know that you don't know, which puts me in a very peculiar position. Imagine sitting up here knowing that you know what I know. We all know we took birth on a plane that's certainly interesting. The Chinese curse, may you be born in an interesting time. Sometimes it's presented as a blessing. The reason it's a curse is because we get so fascinated with it that we forget. And we all know in this room who are awakening, who realize there is an awakening to happen. Who understand that while it seems like we're here to eat and sleep and procreate and have fun, and rear our children and create our civilizations, there's another level where we see this is all a curriculum. It's the laws of karma unfolding. If we remembered that all the time, then we would delight in the dance. We would enjoy the game. We would be at play in the fields of the Lord. But we don't, because we get fascinated. We get fascinated with our own desires, our own fears. We get fascinated with the drama, with our melodrama. Will he, won't he, will she, won't she, should we, shouldn't we, did we, didn't we? If they'd only not done that to me, I'd be. People come to me and they say, should we get married? And I say, it doesn't matter. Can you hear how hard that truth is to hear?
It matters to me.
Try, will we win the war or won't we? Doesn't matter. Matters to me. We'll wait. Attention, be here now. I've been studying how to be a karma yogi. It was not my intention to be a karma yogi. First, I thought I wanted to grow up to be like my father. Then I thought I wanted to be a psychologist. Then when I took psychedelics, I thought I wanted to be high. Then I looked over Eastern literature and hung out with Alan Watts. I decided I really wanted to be a Buddhist. And I wanted to meditate. I had no intention of being a karma yogi. Basically, what happened to me was when I awakened and saw how beautiful it all was just behind the veil of all this stuff, I thought, I don't really want to be here. And I developed a reasonably intense loathing for incarnation. So I became what you would call a renunciate. Sooner I get out of here, the better. So I huffed and I puffed in pranayama. And I meditated to the space between two thoughts. And no matter how hard I pushed away the world, it was still there. And I said, why is it still here? Why haven't I gotten rid of it? I've been a really good Dhyan yogi and Hatha yogi. And when I examined it, I saw that the reason it was still here the way it was because of my aversion to it. That because I hated incarnation, that aversive thought was keeping me stuck. I was busy pushing away something. I've often told the story of Alan Watts and I drinking one night at a Benedictine monastery. And Alan said to me, Dick, you're too attached to emptiness. And he was right. So since by then I wanted to get free, not just high, I did a 180-degree turn and decided to have commerce with the world around me. Since all my renunciate path was getting me was ending up like a horny celibate, I was busy not doing this and that. I realized that people could be celibate and could be renunciate when it was natural in the rhythm of their life or their awareness. But for me, it was really a trip I was laying on myself. Now, when I went to India in 67, and I met Maharaji, my guru, the second day I met him, he called me over. He was sitting on a stone wall, and I was called up to him, and he said, and I my mind was blown by the first day, and I was just crying, and I didn't know what was going on. He said to me, "Do you know Gandhi?" I said, "Well, I don't know him, but I know of him." Then to get a few points, I said, "He was a great saint." Saint in India means really good person. Maharaji said, "Acha." Then he said, "You be like Gandhi." And he hit me on the head 3 times. It was not a tap, but it was not a clout. It was somewhere in between a tap and a clout. And then he sent me away. I thought, what could he mean? How is a Boston Jew going to be like Gandhi? It started a train of thought. It was just a train of confusion, actually. And then sometime later, actually it was several years later, I had the opportunity to once say to Maharaji, "How will I know God?" And he said, "Feed everyone." So I figured something got lost in the translation. You see, you got to understand that being a Western pseudo-intellectual, I was very attached to esoteric spiritual traditions. I loved Madame Blavatsky and Woodruff and secret teachings and the exquisiteness of special initiations. So the answer, feed people. You know, you don't go to India for that. I mean, you take a journey, a mysterious journey to the mysterious East, and you find the great master, and you kneel down before him, and you offer your fruits and flowers, and you say, "How do I know God?" And he says, "Feed people." So I tried again. I said, "How will I get enlightened?" He said, "Serve people." So I thought, what does he know? Because you don't give up easily. And the first time he had said to me, the first time I was in India in 67, I got a message, "Maharaj, he's given you a name, Ramdas." I knew nothing about any of that. I said, "Is it good?" He said, "Oh, very good." Turned out it meant servant of God. And it turned out that in Bhakti Yoga, devotional yoga, there are 9 routes into the center to God. You can come there through, in these devotional paths, through the lover and the beloved, like Krishna and Radha, or like mother to child, like Mary to Jesus. And there is one of servant to master. And that's Ram Dass. And the being that epitomized this in Hindu pantheon was Hanuman, the monkey. Hanuman was a combination, or is a combination, of rascality, as monkeys are, kind of a speedy, agitated thing. Also, a deep quietness. Very great meditation master. But he was known for his dedication to Ram, which was the particular form of God that existed, that manifested in that particular yuga or kalpa, time period.
In fact, he was so close to Ram that he was known as the breath of Ram. That's your, the way your breath is in service to you. So here I am, told to be like Gandhi, told to feed and serve people to get to God, and given the name Servant of God. I mean, that's pretty heavy-handed teaching. And I'm still resisting it, see? And the reason I'm resisting it is because to serve people, to serve God through serving people, involves me in the world very heavily. And I realized that I was still afraid of the world. It was just too weird, too violent, too fascinating, too everything, too abhorrent. So as I said to you yesterday morning, I realized that in my interpretation of the First Noble Truth about suffering was that the basic root of the suffering, as the Second Noble Truth points out, is the clinging of mind, clinging to attraction and aversion. And therefore, if I wanted to serve and feed people, the optimum way to serve and feed people, since I was a spiritual being, was to dispel that ignorance in myself and everybody else. Who was attracted to me as I started to do that kind of teaching through Be Here Now and through lectures and so on were other people who shared that belief system. And as I said yesterday, the people I wasn't dealing with were the people that were just suffering. That didn't want to awaken, they were just suffering. I didn't want to get that thick into the soup. But what you see after a while is that when you do spiritual practices, you get spacious, you get quiet, your heart opens, you are very peaceful, you're equanimous, you're insightful, you're clear. And then you go into the marketplace and you watch how long it takes for you to get caught. It's like the one eye, you've just gotten enlightened in the caves of the Himalayas and you come home to visit your family. And your father says, have you got a job yet? And you lose it, just like that. And if the game is to get free, not just to get high, what you find yourself doing, at least what I found myself doing, was pulling back into spaces like caves or hanging out with other people who shared the view of awareness and God and Buddha and Maharaji and all of the Mishpacha, going back in there until I was so, Om Namah Shivaya and Allah. And then come back out in the marketplace and I could transmute some of it until something heavy would come and then the toxins would build up and I'd start to get really reactive and right, wrong, good, bad, got to do this, I'm tired, achievement, fear. And I think, somebody would say to me, you're really hung up. Say, me hung up, you know. And I'd hear my voice and I think they're right. And so I'd pull back and go into retreat again. But you're constantly reflecting on, what was it that caught me that time? What was it that got me? Because you realize that the only thing that gets you are your clingings of mind. The world doesn't get you. The world's just doing its thing. Saddam Hussein is being an absolute essence Saddam Hussein. George Bush is a perfect George Bush. Central Casting has done exquisitely. See? They're all just doing their thing like elms and oaks and poison ivy. I mean, it's just doing its thing. It's not saying, I'm poison ivy, look at me. They're just doing their thing. And you're busy saying, no, yes, And you see it's your mind that's doing it. I don't like oaks. If we can get rid of oaks, we can have a peaceful world here. So recognizing that the toxicity is in my mind, not out there, then as it builds up, I'm examining, why is it building up? What's grabbing at me? What in me is grabbing? Is it my fear of death? Is it my fear of suffering? Is it my fear of giving up the model of who I think I am? My fear of giving up my MG? Who knows? My fear of shame. See, Gandhi's autobiography was called Experiments of Truth. And he said, I'm just a human. If I were God, I would know truth. But I'm a human and I'm limited in what I can know. And my understanding of truth changes from day to day. So if you don't find me consistent, it's because I'm committed to truth, not to consistency. That's a big one right there. As you reflect on the relation between truth and freedom, you see that relative truths keep moving you towards absolute truth, which is not knowable, but just beable. And you see ultimately that you just have to die into truth. You have to die into God. You have to die into love, whatever it is. Gandhi had another great line. He said, when you surrender completely to God, which is the only truth worth having, you find yourself in the service of all that exists. It becomes your joy and recreation. You never tire of it. Look at your life and ask how much of your everyday activity is your joy and recreation. And how much of it is the kind of action of which you never tire? Like, I go to the toilet numerous times a day. I don't get tired going to the toilet. It's just something I do. Usually when I'm going to the toilet, I'm either reflecting about the universe or something. I'm really not busy going to the toilet. Therein lies one of the secrets of karma yoga. It's enunciated in the Bhagavad Gita. It says, be not identified with being the actor.
I'm going to the toilet now. It's like how you drive a car. Most of you drive, but you don't sit around saying, I'm driving. Some of you do, but those are the ones to watch out for. But the others, I mean, they're driving, they're talking to somebody, they're listening to the news, they're fantasizing where they're going or where they came from, looking in the mirror for policemen, whatever. So what I'm seeing is that if I want to be free, I have to deal with my aversion to incarnation. What is my aversion to? It's to suffering that is endless. What am I going to do about it? I will have to have commerce with suffering that is endless. But not only do I have to have commerce with it, but my objective is that it is joyful. Then I will be free. As I start to open to this person, who has AIDS, as I start to really open my heart to the feelings of social ostracism, to falling through the air with no economic net, to dealing with one's body becoming ugly, weak, painful, undependable, because of the opportunistic nature of the illness. How far do I open? Who is this before me? Is this us in love? To whom this is happening? Or do I distance myself and say it's happening to him or to her? Each time I work with my reactions of closing down, of distancing myself from the distressing disguises of God, of my guru, of my beloved, I see myself having forgotten once again into fear. I flickered. I sit with the situation. I quiet my mind while holding a hand or just sitting by a bed. I go deeper within myself, far behind my identification and fears, back into awareness, mindful of our predicament but no longer lost in it. The humanity is there, but so too is spacious awareness. I have come back into love, and I feel the barriers between me and the other being dissolve. I am with the fear and the pain, with it yet simultaneously behind it. We are together, entering into the cave where we are no longer alone in our suffering. But together, behind and within it. Just one more reading. It's This is from a book I'm working on now. I hold a boy dying of AIDS. I am gentle. My face is buried in his hair. Our hearts are open. Right here. Right here inside our hearts. We are not dying boy and kindly man. We are two beings, recognizing one another through and behind the drama. We share the awe of the moment, the peace that lies at the center of the whirlwind of fear and confusion. That timeless moment is enough for both of us. We are healed. We are in the domain of love. We are free. I am addicted to love. I am addicted to being in love. In fact, to fall out of love becomes so painful. And it is all in my mind. And when I am searching for the ways to stay in love, I hear my guru saying, feed people, serve people, love everybody. Tell the truth. So I serve more, and I find myself more in love. What is wonderful is that the love lies not as a reward, like a gold star for being a good helper. The love lies within the act itself. For when you offer yourself into service, it opens your own heart to allow you to taste again the sweet awareness of your own heart's compassion. Karma Yoga. Coming into union through doing one's dharma. Dharma, in this case, meaning each one's unique way. Each of us has a unique karmic predicament. For each of us, there is an appropriate route back to the source. Your route isn't my route. Her route isn't her route. We can't imitate another's route. I can't imitate Gandhi. I can just hear my guru say, be like Gandhi, and then let it wash through me, and then just keep doing what I do in life. If you're washing dishes, wash dishes. In the washing of the dishes is the whole thing. If you're attached to getting done with washing the dishes, you will suffer and burn out. If you're washing the dishes the way tulips bloom, because it's just in the way of things, the dishwashing is happening. Ah, so.
then the moment becomes enough. That's karma yoga. Coming into union, coming into the fullness of the moment through every act. All that's required is that you have a context or philosophical frame of reference that allows you to look at your life as an experiment in truth, or an opportunity to awaken, or a life curriculum, or meditation in action, whatever you want to call it. But the events take on a different meaning. One farmer is tilling his field to get the food to eat, and that's all his mind is saying. The other farmer is tilling the field as an act of being with the beloved. And as a result of it, food comes. The first farmer, sooner or later, is tired with his work, anxious lest he not get the reward. The second farmer is fulfilled in the doing of the act. What I am doing now is my dharma. For me, this is an act of worship. I'm not doing this and then later I'll go be with God. If this isn't it, forget it. So who are you? For me, just for me in my pathology, you are my guru in drag. You're appearing to be many, but I know who you are. You're saying, I bet you can't find me behind this mask. You really think we're somebody and you're giving a lecture, don't you? Poor baby. But I see through the mask. I honor the individual differences and I laugh at them. I appreciate your uniqueness and I love being in love with you where we aren't separate. What you do with your mind is your problem. My job is to stay in love. So there I am, serving and feeding who? The beloved. That's all there is. I go to the grocery store. I'm at the checkout counter. Who's checking the dishes? Who's checking the groceries out? Is it her or is it us? Is it us or is it me? How distant am I going to keep this person from me? Can I fall in love at the grocery checkout counter? Can I afford not to? Karma yoga, not being attached to being the actor, not being attached to the fruits of the action. And you serve the beloved. That's who you serve. When Mother Teresa says, I am serving Christ in all his distressing disguises. Somebody says, isn't she wonderful to help the lepers in the streets of Calcutta? But if you were serving your beloved and you saw somebody as your beloved lying in the street, wouldn't you want to go over and lift them up? And if somebody said, oh, you're so courageous, wouldn't it seem silly? I mean, what else would you want to do? Leave your beloved lying there? Rabindranath Tagore said, I slept and dreamt that life was service, dharma, duty. I awoke and I saw, now let me take it again. You all know it too. I slept and dreamt that life was joy. I awoke and saw that life was service. I acted, and behold, service was joy. To have the philosophical context, like for me, Maharaji is my imaginary playmate. He died in 73. His body died. But now, just to humor my psychosis, imagine what it's like to have an imaginary playmate who's infinitely wise, very humorous, quite a rascal, very caring and very compassionate, and who hangs out with you all the time. And every time you get outrageous, your imaginary playmate's just going, ah-ha-ha-ha, or giggling, ha. Now, I know he's an imaginary playmate. However, so are you, and he's more real to me most of the time than you are. I told you I'd share my psychosis. And what I experience is that as I hang out with him more and more, not the man in the blanket, but the qualities of humor, of wisdom, of emptiness, of compassion, of joy, of giggle, of seeing it all lightly. Like at one moment when it was terrible in the world and I was so caught in it as we are now, and I was sitting before my guru, he said to me, Ram Dass, don't you see it's all perfect? I said, perfect? Can you see this is perfect? And he looked at me with such, oh, if I could only tell you. It's like in the Gita. Krishna, Arjuna looks and it's such a horrible war he's about to fight. And he throws down his arms and he says, I won't fight. And Krishna says, you've got to do whatever your dharma is. And Arjuna says, no, it's too horrible. And Krishna says, look, I'll show you. And he opens his third eye and Arjuna sees the whole drama unfolding, all within the body of Krishna.
This concludes side one. Please turn the tape over without rewinding to continue.